It's time now for RPG Circus, the greatest show in gaming. In this episode, we have a review for you, finally, of Fantasy Warhammer 3rd Edition. We talk about using terrain in combat situations. And finally, we have a little talk about predictability in gaming. Again, welcome to Season 2, Episode 9 of RPG Circus. My name is Jeff, and with me, as usual, is Zach and Mark. Welcome.
Hey, good to be back.
Yeah, good to have you back.
Yeah, it's good to be back. It's good to be recording.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad.
Always.
So, yeah, it's been a heck of a week for me, and so I'm glad to finally be recording this episode. We're actually recording this a day late, but it should still be out by the weekend. So, I'm happy about that.
Very good.
Is there anything we need to talk about before we get started?
No, let's jump into the news.
All right, yeah, well, let's go to the news. Yes, the news. Well, the big news is the eligibility period for the innies is just 2 days away at the time we record this. April 31st is the final cutoff date. If you are an RPG content creator, be it a published product, podcast, video cast, I don't know, you name it, if you make RPG underwear, I guess, you have 2 days until, you have to have your product out and, by that date. Your submissions have to be postmarked by the 7th of May. That is 1 week from this upcoming Saturday. And right now, we have about we've submitted obviously this podcast for consideration, yeah. And there actually are 10 other entries right now as we speak, which is kind of good and bad. We talked about this before the show started, and we were both excited. And well, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens. So, a couple of them I haven't heard of before. I was kind of shocked.
There are a lot of RPG podcasts out there.
I agree. There are a lot of RPG podcasts. Some of them are good. Some of them are bad. Some of them are I don't know.
Some of them are kind of fly by night, and they do 3 episodes, and that's it.
Yeah that kind of brings us up. Speaking of podcasts that I won't say they're fly by night, but. The Open Design Podcast ceases production.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the Kobold Quarterly guys. And they just decided that their time's better spent doing something else. And I can actually understand that. I mean, it takes a lot of time and energy to do a podcast. Sure. Don't let the mere fact that we only produce an episode every 2 weeks confuse you. It actually takes a lot of planning to actually sit down and go like, oh, what are we going to talk about? Or is there any news? So I can understand it. It's a little sad. Mm-hmm. But I'm glad to see.
And people contribute to the hobby in different ways. You've only got so much time to do it, so better to bow out and concentrate on where you think your time will be best spent.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so I'm really sad about that, but I understand. Well, on another news, we have Goodman Games has posted PDF downloads for the player handouts and pre-generated characters for Age of Cthulhu Adventures. Yes, I pronounce it Cthulhu. I don't know how else to pronounce it. That's what
I've always pronounced it.
I know, but if you actually look at the letters, it never makes any sense to pronounce it that way.
No, it doesn't. Well, it wasn't meant to be spoken by human lips.
Exactly. So, that's where we get that, folks. We just say the heck with it. We're not going to do it at all. On the other hand, let's see what else we got for news. We have IDW to apparently do a new D&D comic. I'm not sure. I guess it might be interesting, but I don't know. I understand the crossover, but I'm unenthused.
I don't understand because I know that as of think it was last summer, I ended up picking up a comic that was Worlds of D&D that had Dragonlance and some stuff from Forgotten Realms and stuff. I'm not sure what exactly they're going to be doing differently that's this brand new, exciting.
I'm not sure. Didn't Devils do publishing, or someone used to do a D&D comic circa 3rd edition, I think? I remember visiting their booth at Gen Con, so.
I'm not sure. I know that I do have the first book of The Legend of Drizzt in trade paperback form.
I've seen something like that. Comics and me have kind of parted ways in a lot of ways. You know, now I watch Justice League Unlimited with the daughter, or Batman Beyond, or
Brave and the Bold.
Yeah, Brave and the Bold, something like that. That's about it for comics these days.
Well, honestly, I have two choices. I either can spend money on games or I can spend money on comics, and I think games win for me.
Yeah.
You know, there are a lot of people out there that apparently have a lot of free currency to do just whatever they feel like. So there you go.
That's how I feel whenever I see anyone getting involved with minis, painting miniatures. You know, they have these giant collections. How do you do it?
You know,
game books and you do that? How?
Well, I'll tell you right now, for myself, I won't say I have a really large collection, but I do have an army transport case full of minis. And honestly, I did that one piece at a time over, I mean, that case spans, oh, I don't know, at least now since 1992. So that's what, 18 years? Right?
Yeah. It's been a while. That's the way to do it.
You know, that's what, I mean, it's 18 years of money spent. So yeah, that's why I have a large collection. Mm. You know, I'll find out I need something, so I'll go out and buy it. So, but there you go. I mean, that's it. Other than that, I think that's pretty much all the news. Oh, not that I misspoke. We had some late breaking news. Zach, you want to tell people about this one?
Which one are we talking about?
Let's go with WotC.
Oh, yeah, and this is just from the last hour or so. We just happened to see this. Is evidently the Wizards of the Coast lawyers sent a cease and desist, or a letter to Morris, the head of N-World, over some member content, we should say. And it sounds like basically they had some posters who were, shall we say, borrowing liberally from some of the books or from the DDI. I'm not quite sure which. Good to know WotC is looking out for their stuff, I guess. But one of the things Morris was saying that was sort of interesting was that back when Scott Rouse was still with D&D, with WotC, it used to be that he'd get kind of a friendly email or message when that would happen, not a lawyer gram. So I know a lot of people, even people who don't play 4E, were impressed with Scott Rouse and how he often tried to smooth over ruffled feathers and tried to be a good ambassador, I think, whenever possible. So maybe that relationship has shifted now that he's out and WotC continues the revolving door. So who knows? But yeah, bottom line, don't post WotC's IP stuff on N-World because they're watching.
And I guess the last news item before we get into the full blank of the show is that I guess there was a post on the RPG site .com's forums that Necromancy Games is actually sort of still around, and they're going to be doing some stuff for Pathfinder. Apparently, was that the way I read that?
That's the gist I'm getting, and that's actually a repost from the Necromancer forums.
Okay. Boards,
Right. And we'll see if anything comes of it. It's a pretty, it's a big multi-part adventure series, the Slumbering Czar Saga. Evidently, it was a mega adventure that was originally for 3rd edition that's getting the Pathfinder bump. So we'll see. It's not technically
Necromancer. There's three different sections broken into. It looks like there's three different primary parts. Each one of those primary parts is broken into one or more parts, and it looks like almost like there's 5, 6, and 3. That's 14.
Yeah.
So.
So I mean, Necromancer's been pretty quiet. Once upon a time, they were pretty well regarded for bringing along. Of course, their motto was always third edition rules, first edition feel, and they had some really good products that they did for third edition. But they've just kind of been ever since fourth ed came out, they really haven't done much, if anything. There's been long periods of silence, and so even though I guess this isn't going to technically be under Necromancer, it's got the Necromancer blessing, so. We'll see what comes of it. It's pretty ambitious, and we haven't seen anything yet. So I've been a gamer long enough to have a little bit of skepticism, but I wish him the best.
All right. Well, I think that does it for the news. And so we go to the first topic of the hour. And if you're like us, we've been kind of waiting for this one there, Mark. It's time to actually have your review of Fantasy Warhammer.
Yeah.
The latest edition. Edition 3, right?
Yes, third edition.
Okay, I don't really keep track sometimes. There's too much stuff to keep track of.
Well, first edition and second edition were pretty much, you could use the stuff, sort of mix it together, kind of like third edition and 3.5. But I can assure everybody that it is not a board game.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yes. There are pieces, there are little bits that remind one of a board game, but that's because that's what Fantasy Flight is known for, is their all of their elaborate bits and stuff. But in no way does it resemble a board game in any way once you're actually
doing things.
I haven't actually gotten a chance to actually play it, but I've seen it played, and I've looked over everything, and if you actually were to be sitting down and playing it, it wouldn't be a board game at all.
Well, that's good. I mean,
yeah. I know that was you guys' big concern.
Well, I'm still concerned that their dice are a little proprietary, aren't they still?
Yeah, but actually, one of the big concerns from everybody was that they would end up basically coming out with just the dice in the core set, and you wouldn't be able to get them any other way, and they actually did release a pack of dice.
Well, that's good.
So you can just get the dice now, and it's enough dice for one person.
I was going to say, that was my big worry is, you know, we all sit down, and if your board games at your house are anything like mine, your Monopoly game no longer resembles the original packaging, you know?
Yeah.
And because it's played with a board here, I was worried about the same thing with Warhammer. Because, oh, crap, where's the die? You know, where's the special whatever? Where's this? Where's that? Now we can't play, or we got to use, you know. Looking at it, it looked so proprietary to me. Even though the production values are really high, that was kind of a turnoff for me.
Yeah, I can see like people being concerned about losing some of the cards, but I mean, I have a closet full of board games, and all of them are still retaining their cards. So for me, it's not really an issue. I keep a good track of all of my stuff. They've got some interesting stuff in it. Actually, I ended up taking a tackle box and putting all the little pieces inside separated, because there is a lot of pieces, and if you just throw them back into the box,
you're never going to be able to.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? That's just like most of their games, because I played. Ooh, what the heck is that one? It's a Cthulhu game, like game.
Arkham Horror.
Yeah.
We played that once or twice, and. Yeah, if you don't have baggies to hold your pieces, and then if you don't have bowls to put your pieces in, you're going to be sorely, sorely mistaken later.
Yeah. But they've got little cardboard stand-ups of a bunch of different types of monsters, and a little stand-up for each one of the careers. And what you've got is there's a bunch of cards that have different careers on them. And let me actually open up the... I got a little one of the tuck boxes that comes with it. It comes with three tuck boxes, but they're only the right size for the career cards. So what they expect you to do is that you're supposed to. Basically, the set is for three players and a DM, and each player is supposed to get a little tuck box and put their career and their dice and their cards and everything in there. But they've got all kinds of different careers, like warrior priests, There's a coachman.
Do they have the rat catcher still?
I was about to ask you about the rat catcher.
They don't, but what they do have is in the first expansion they've released that's a bunch of new careers and stuff. It's primarily for players. They have released the rat catcher, and he comes with a pet dog that runs around and helps him catch the rats.
That's kind
of fun. Is there anyone who did not... Was that not the favorite career of everyone who ever like just looked at Warhammer was the rat catcher? Yes.
Oh, I don't know. I thought that was always the troll slayer dwarf guy, you know, the little orange mohawk guy.
Yeah, they do have the troll slayer in here. And then your whole group actually, they sort of get a class career type thing. They only released, let's see, 5 in the main set. And you basically, it gives you a reason to have your whole party together instead of trying to explain why you suddenly have this, you know, Priest of Sigmar with a troll slayer with, you know, something.
Because everyone's insane. Come on. You know
exactly.
That.
But they've got the Intrepid Explorers, the Brash Young Fools, Swords for Hire, Gang of Thugs, and Servants of Justice.
I think most people would be going for the just the Thugs or Swords for Hire.
Yeah, Thugs.
Fine. And then from what I hear, there's more that came out with the players. I can't remember what it's called. Sometimes there's a players expansion. And then they just also released the Dungeon Masters or the Game Masters expansion as well, which has more stuff for the Game Masters. But the way the game works is that you've got these specific dice, and instead of the player and the DM each rolling dice against each other and everything, the player will roll a certain number of colored dice based on what type of attack he's making, and then if there's any complications, like the enemy has armor or the player's on unsure footing or something, they'll add in complication dice, which will basically cancel out good dice depending on how the dice roll. And you can end up getting really amazing successes or really spectacular failures. And the way that that's worked out is with when you play a card, every single character is either being conservative or being aggressive. And that's marked with a little... There's sort of a little tracking board that you set up for yourself that either it's either more leaned more towards the green or more towards the red. And if you're in the red, then you're more aggressive. And if you're in the green, you're more conservative with everything. And you actually, if you want to move more conservative, which would mean that your successes aren't as successful, but your failures aren't as bad. Whereas with the aggressive, your attacks or your successes are much more fantastic, but your successes or your failures are just, you'll chop off your leg, you know, because you're just being
too aggressive. So it's sort of like having an offensive and a defensive stance.
Exactly. You choose your stance, but certain occupations are leaning more towards one than the other. So for a troll slayer, it's going to be really, really unlikely that you're going to ever end up going
conservative.
Conservative, exactly. And you can shift one space to the left or right on your track as far as conservative or aggressive. But if you want to go more than that, then you actually have to, it expends more energy to be able to do so. When you take damage, you actually take a wound card, which just has a couple of like slashes across it. But then if you flip it over because you've taken a critical hit, it'll actually give you some actual critical damage. They're usually pretty serious injuries. They have spitting teeth. We actually lose teeth from the attack. There's quite a few flesh wounds. Punch drunk, you basically just start stumbling around a little bit, and you aren't as good at fighting because you were hit in the head or you're losing too much blood. You can end up suffering a concussion. You can have a ruptured spleen. There's all kinds of really, really gritty little wounds that you can end up taking through that. And so that's a really interesting way of doing it, whereas instead of just... instead of you having to roll, and if you get a critical, then check on a different table to see what type of critical wound you take, you actually, it's just part of your whole wound. All the wounds that you normally take. Another interesting thing they did is instead of telling you that basically you need a board to be able to do anything like you do in D&D, instead they have these cards that are different locations, and they'll have things like a wizard's tower, a secret passageway, an old dirt road, a marketplace, a dilapidated shrine, crumbling ruins, abandoned cemetery, things like that. And you could just have everybody inside the wizard's tower as where the fight is, and you basically place everybody's tokens on the wizard's tower piece. But you could do things like have some people in the wizard's tower, but a couple of the players have discovered a secret passageway, and so you actually would put the card next to the wizard's tower showing that there's two separate locations where things are taking place in.
Mark, what's the ratio here of GM control versus player control? It sounds like it's pretty player controlled. If there is
quite a bit of player control, but I think that the way it's set up is the GM is really, really firmly the one holding the reins. The players are able to sort of. It's pretty easy for them to diverge to how they want, but. It feels like the GM really has. You don't ever wonder who's running the show here.
Who's in charge? Yeah.
Yeah.
For example, for locations, I mean, the GM is setting those. The GM is defining those. It's not something where the player can seize narrative control and.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, all right. Well, you mentioned locations. What's like an effect because of the location? Is that how those cards
work? Yeah, there'll be effects. On the back of the card, it'll give an effect. Like the abandoned cemetery. Fear and terror ratings are increased by one in the abandoned cemetery. Willpower tests gain two skulls, add two cross swords to the results pool, which actually does mean something. I know it just sounds like...
No, I mean, that's whatever their mechanic is for that.
Right.
Exactly. But it's if you're in the abandoned cemetery, you're more likely to get freaked out and your willpower is a little bit weakened. But the players can affect things in the game themselves through their either conservative or more aggressive stances, and the game is actually much more, your game is much more descriptive than if you were just playing a game of D&D and you're just throwing dice. It sort of sets more to your character's personality, whether or not you're more aggressive or conservative, and you choose when you create your character which way your character actually leans on the scale. When you've got character creation, you say, okay, my character, even though he's got more aggressive than conservative, I'm actually going to start him off at conservative, where he can fly into a rage, but he tries to keep himself calm. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask, how many locations come with the basic set?
There aren't as many as I'd like. Let me see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. There's 12. And they only have one magical item. It's called Cordon's Hammer. And that is used in the adventure that the game comes with. And you're supposed to give it back at the end of the session. So, but it's one that you can use further on. And I've heard the DM or the GM's guide has a lot more magical items in it.
Okay, so do they have rules for your creation of your own, or do you think you could just whip something up?
You could probably whip something up. They don't really have rules for that creation, but I'm sure, again, in the DM's guide, that they probably have a lot more. One interesting thing that they've got, too, with the careers is that you choose, on the side of your career, you've got a couple of slots for you to put extra little, they're sort of feat cards. They're special abilities that your character and your character alone has. So like for the apprentice wizard, you got one space for order and one space for focus. And order is always the sort of order of magic that your wizard or your cleric is behind. Or I guess the cleric type character has more, they have faith for theirs. But then focus, there's a bunch of cards you can flip through and you choose what your character's focus is. And that's a special little feat. That they also have reputation and tactic. There's a couple characters that they just have two spots for tactic, where characters really tactical. And let me see if I can...
I think I've seen a video cast. Also, doesn't the party class, if you will, have like a slot for something?
Yeah, the party class also has some slots. And what players can do is they can give their feat to the party. So they can, temporarily... So the entire party would get this special focus ability or reputation ability. So that's actually a really kind of nifty thing. And then if you complete your career, like you could with in previous versions of Warhammer, you actually get to keep that card. You get to keep one of your cards from your career, and then you get to move on to a new career, and then you get a couple other feat cards. So yeah, there's really nothing that, besides the look of the pieces, that really lends itself towards board gaming, and so much so that they don't even have a board at all, and they don't encourage you to use a board, which is surprising considering they are Warhammer, and I know it's not actually made by Games Workshop itself, but I can imagine Games Workshop wanting people to play the games on Warhammer boards and things like that, but they don't mention that at all.
Well,
so.
Yeah, because I remember that was the one thing about the early, at least the edition that I got, is that, you know, the stats were almost verbatim from the actual miniature game.
Yeah, and it's not like that at all anymore.
Wow.
Well, let's talk about cost for a sec, because, you know, on Amazon it is cheaper, of course. Mm-hmm. In a lot of the stores, I'm not sure how much you were able to snag yours for, but in a lot of the shops, we're seeing some pretty high prices for... Well, comparatively high prices. I don't want to say that, because depending on what you get. But a lot of people, when you get up into the $80 range for a game, they kind of bulk, even though you can easily spend that for three core books on some games.
Yeah.
So given what you have, and it does sound sort of like it's geared towards including these later expansion sets, which I, you know, I understand the reasoning for. How do you think for bang for your buck?
Well, actually, my copy I got from my brother for my birthday, and he works at Fantasy Flight, which that's not tainting my review at all.
Hey, you mentioned it, right? So you got the disclaimer.
Exactly, I mentioned it. No, I think it's definitely worth the $100 that you typically would find at a game store. If you're looking at buying just the three core D&D rule books, they're $35-$40 a piece. So you're looking at $120 for the three core rule books. And then if you look at, you know, adding in the Dungeon Master's Guide 2 and the Player's Handbook 2, those are each another $40. And that's, I think it's about $30 or $40 for the Player's expansion and the Dungeon Master's or the Game Master's expansion. So in the end, you would be getting a ton of stuff for the exact same price as Player's Handbook 1 and 2, DMG 1 and 2, and Monster Manual. Oh, and then there's Monster Manual 2, of course. So,
yeah.
I think actually it's a better deal. You're getting a lot more stuff. And one of the nicer things is that if you look at it, you have to go flipping through the books if you're looking for feats in D&D. In this, you flip through a deck of cards. If you're looking for a new class, you're flipping through a bunch of books in D&D. In this, you're flipping through cards. So it adds a layer of incorporating everything together within further expansions that come out. If they release a new supplement that's got, say they release an adventure that's got 10 new magic items in it along that you encounter along the way, at the end of the adventure, you can just incorporate those into your deck of magic items. So I think it makes it so it's a lot easier to sort of throw everything together. Also, they do have a sheet of, I would guess, probably about 50 character sheets. And you can find their character sheets also for free on their website. So you don't have to worry about running out of those and then not being able to make any more characters.
What about gameplay speed, 40 versus Warhammer? Are you seeing people play it? How fast is a single round of combat comparatively?
Runs a lot faster. Combat ends a lot quicker. Combat's a lot more brutal. You suddenly take a head wound and you're going to want to duck behind something and just sort of wait out the rest of the fight. You are a lot tougher than you were in previous editions of Warhammer Fantasy. In previous editions, you basically knew that if any fight you got into, you were going to die. In this, you'll survive, but you'll walk away missing an eye.
So that's why they call me Patchy, right?
Exactly. I'm more familiar myself with the Mordheim era of the Empire. I don't know if either of you played Mordheim, but it's supposed to take place like, I think it's like 1,000 years before the current timeline. Because I used to play Mordheim all the time growing up throughout high school. And so I'd probably run a game in that, and the game doesn't really, it mentions in the flavor text stuff leaning more towards the year 3000 or whatever the current year is, but it doesn't necessarily limit you with just playing that era. There's three books. There's the Tome of Adventure, which is the core rule book. You have the Tome of Blessing. Wait, no, there's four books. You have the core rule book, which has all the rules. The Tome of Adventure, which is more the Dungeon Master's Guide, and there's an adventure in there. There's the Tome of Blessings, which is a bunch of different stuff for doing divine magic, and the Tome of Mysteries, which is all about arcane magic. So you're actually getting four books in there. They're all paperback, unfortunately. But the cool thing is you can actually now get all the books on RPG Now in digital form. So you can get them all. I think they only sell them separately, but they're fairly cheap. So you're able to go through and you can use that for any, if you want to, you know, read up on it and not worry about messing up your books.
Well, that's kind of cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean, do you see this as something you can do for a long-term game, or do you see this more of a short to medium run?
I would say probably a medium run. I can't imagine running 5 years of the exact same party, because they don't really have levels. They just have you moving from one career to the next. I would imagine a group would be more interested in playing a medium chain and then starting a new campaign with a different group of characters. But I could definitely see playing it for a long period of time. We're moving in less than a month up to Chicago, and I'm definitely thinking about looking at getting my getting whatever players I find up there into playing Warhammer.
That's right. I forget. That's exciting. It's one of the reasons you're going to join us at Gen Con, right?
Exactly. So I'll be up there.
We'll get into that a little bit later in the episode.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of cool. I'm still not sure personally if I have the money to actually drop on the game, especially since, you know, I'm not sure I could actually find players right now to play that game.
But maybe I'll bring it up to Gen Con and play with you guys.
Yeah, that might be something.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That might be cool. You know, Stargazer's going to be there too. So.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So maybe we'll get him in. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, excellent. Are there any final thoughts on it before we move on?
No, do you have any other questions, Zach?
Not offhand, but I reserve the right to just ambush you totally at
Absolutely.
A future date on this. So,
yeah. They do, a bunch of people have online begun releasing their own careers and basically putting them in JPEG format of the exact size that the other careers are, and I've actually gotten four printed and cut out, and they actually blend right in with the rest of the career cards.
Oh,
the
only difference is
they don't have the same backs.
Ooh, hurt me.
as that. But they blend right in. It's been pretty cool.
Well, that's pretty cool that at least, you know, people are starting, at least they don't have a problem with that. That's good. At least not so far.
Yeah. so far, yeah.
So I'm happy about that. Well, I guess we'll go on to our next topic. And the next topic is, well, basically in the last episode, we talked about Paizo's flip mats, which were the inside of various monsters. And that kind of got me to thinking about something. And that was the saying, location, location, a location. You know, one of the biggest pieces of advice I've ever seen in a adventuring manual was when you have combat, it should be at an exciting location. And, you know, I tend to forget about that, too. I mean, I do that all the time. It's sometimes the adventure locations are rather boring. And I don't mean like, you know, boring in a conventional sense. I mean, it's boring in terms of what players can interact with. Does that make sense to you guys?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, and the problem for a game master is that, you know, which, interestingly enough, when the way you describe the Fantasy Warhammer, they kind of address this. Well, what are the effects of being at that location? Are there certain things that give the players advantages or disadvantages? You know, do you have to, you know, are you on the deck of a rolling ship and you have to make some sort of weird deck save or sailing, you know, skill roll or something of that nature to, you know, not move a certain number of feet? It's almost, it's hard to describe it. It's almost like, you know, and for certain exciting locations, you almost have to have a game within the game. That's why I've already described it.
Yeah. I can do that.
So I'm just kind of, and it's like, I don't know. I mean, I've always been, sometimes I'm opposed to that because then, you know, it's like, well, if you have a game within the game, you better write those, whatever you decided down, because the next time it comes up, people are going to be expecting that. So it's kind of, I don't know how else to describe it. It's just kind of weird in that regard. I mean, but that said, you know, if you have a very exciting location, you know, where that players can interact with, you know, they can pick up chairs, they can throw chairs at people. You know, it makes combat a little more interesting and a little more exciting. It gives them more options. You know,
rather than just another plane clearing.
You know, another plane clearing. Are there boulders they can hide behind? Are there boulders they can get on top of? Are there advantages to getting on top of the boulder? Are there disadvantages to getting on top of the boulder? You know, it's funny, even with miniatures, sometimes when I look at the board, I forget that there are three dimensions.
Yeah.
And
oh, yeah.
What was that?
Oh, I was agreeing. Absolutely.
Yeah, and I don't know anyone that doesn't. It's like, because you look at the board and you start thinking two-dimensionally on everything. And it's really and it's really hard to break, you know, which is one of the reasons that when I use my miniatures, I especially, you know, I have some furniture and I like to use the furniture and I like to use the crates and I like to use the barrels and everything. Even if it's never mentioned in the adventure or whatever, it's like I like to throw them out there because it gives, you know, it makes you remember that there are objects there. And it's important. But, you know, I mean, let's just take any action movie. Take an action movie, you know. Pick an action movie. Pick any action movie.
Oh, Die Hard.
Yeah. Well,
yeah. I was actually thinking Die Hard.
Well, yeah. I mean, think of all the weird locations that they had fights.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on top of the roof, you know, in different places.
Way up a skyscraper. Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's very important that those things happen. They make, you know, it breathes excitement into the adventure because, I mean, not the adventure, but that scene. And even though I don't like to sometimes bring in the thought of, you know, applying movie-like terminology and practices to RPGs, as a game master, you are a little bit of the director and you do have to set the scene. And you need something that the players, who are actors in their own rights in a way, you know, granted they have their own free will, what they're going to be doing, but you need to give them something. You need to give them some, a foundation. I mean, let's face it. What's the ancient typical start of the adventure? You're all in a tavern and someone approaches you. How boring is that?
Yeah.
You know, and don't get me wrong. I mean, it's very hard to describe an exciting tavern. It really is. I've tried, and it's just like, you know, either the players aren't into it or you're too into it. You know, and I've met some people where they're way too into the scene. It's just like, okay, let's just get on with the adventure. And so it is a balancing act. But one of my favorite covers, and I forget what it was, but it was like the scene of a bazaar. It was like, you know, some adventurers are like at the entrance to the bazaar. And, you know, when I see that, it's like, wow, could you imagine fighting a combat inside the bazaar and all the weird things that you would have to deal with? Now, as a game master, you have to, obviously, if you're playing something like D&D, you have to think of what the effects of that might be. You know, and you might have to come up with rules that don't necessarily apply anywhere else. So, I don't know. I mean, have you guys ever really dealt with that?
I've had some... Go ahead, Zach.
Oh, I was going to say, yeah, I have. And I think sometimes the right scenery can be the difference between if you don't have a lot going on that night. Sometimes just a good scenic battle or encounter or location can really save your bacon as a GM. Because the players begin to interact with that. They begin to see what this does, what that does. I had about a couple months ago, we had a fight that went, first it went a lot worse than I thought it would, then it went a lot better. And, you know, it would have been a really uneven combat, but they were basically in the middle of this forest with these pools that would teleport to other pools in the forest. And so the players figured this out and started popping in and out of the pools and trying them out and trying to get behind the enemy, and the enemy was jumping in the pools. It was a lot of fun. It required a lot of – I had to keep looking at my notes to see what pool went where, but the players started to really get into it. And what really was a pretty light night on what I had planned turned into a pretty epic battle. And so it kind of lessened the strain on me as a GM having to come up with a lot. And it was, I think, a much more memorable battle than just another clearing.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I think that's kind of why when you look in the first edition DMG, there's all those notes on all the different types, you know, the outdoor adventures, the underwater adventures, you know, and all those very unique locations that you have to deal with in that situation. I mean, even, you know, and I think that's why, in some ways, at a certain point, we started getting away from the prototypical dungeon, is because it was boring.
Yeah.
And we still do that. I mean, we still do a lot of dungeons, and sometimes they are very boring. You know, that's why things like the one-page dungeon contest are very exciting, because it's amazing what people can still do with the dungeon format. You know, how inventive can they get?
I think as far as dungeons went, for a while we kind of got stuck in a collective rut as far as expectations. But it's just like anything else in gaming. You hit that rut where dwarves have a Scottish accent and are greedy miners, and elves are elves, you know. And with dungeons, I think we got into this expectation of here's what you're going to have. And there's a period of dungeon design, I think, and dungeon play where it was just really some of the innovation just really seemed to leach out of it for a while.
Yeah.
So, I don't think that's the case today, although there certainly are still some dungeons out there that are more traditional. And I think that's been out of the public eye long enough that it's fresh and exciting again.
Well,
some people have never stopped playing, and that's what they want. And that's awesome.
Well, you got to remember too. I mean, I consider myself a little bit of an older fogey when it comes to gaming. So there's a lot of newer guys that, you know, you talk to them about first edition D&D and you might as well be talking to Martians.
Right.
So. I've ended up with some really interesting locations in some of my games. A couple months ago, the players ended up stumbling upon a hell forge, which was a creation forge in Eberron that had been corrupted by the elemental chaos and everything. And basically they went inside of it and there's all these turning gears. And so not every single turn, but every single round, the gears were actually turning and it was shifting everybody's spots. And so nobody was really quite sure where they would be because everybody's standing on these different gears that were all turning at different speeds. And it actually made things a lot more interesting.
That sounds fun.
Well, yeah. That sounds fun, but man, that sounds like a lot of paperwork.
They just didn't realize that I was just sort of making it up as I went. So
there really was no paperwork. Now that's to funny. It.
GM's best weapon.
And then actually, Zach, I had a similar situation to you where there was some little pools in a different place in the forest, and it caused people hopping all over the place. And again,
that's fun.
I just said that it was, the elemental chaos at work. And so wherever they stepped, it was a completely random place that they ended up teleporting to. I wasn't even rolling for it behind the screen. I was just sticking them somewhere else random. So
you're going there.
Way to do it.
My players caught on to it a lot quicker than I thought they would. And they just started popping out all over the place. So
yeah,
it was, that's how players do though. You give them any sort of advantage. Of course, a lot of backstabbing went on that day. So
yeah,
still, but it's exciting.
It was fantastic. So Mark, when you were talking about the rotating gears and everything, mm-hmm. there's a Dungeon Crawl Classic adventure by Monty Cook, and the name is completely escaped me, but it's actually got this little rotating, it's basically like a rotating kind of dungeon.
And really?
For the life of me, I can't think of what it is. Something iron, clockwork, I don't know, I can't remember. But it kind of goes along those same lines. And it actually had a little wheel in there that you turn, and that will show you the orientation of the dungeon.
Oh, that's cool.
So talk about that kind of dynamic location. That's a good one, I think.
Yeah, and in 4th edition, the DMGs, they've actually done a really good job of having whole sections where there's all kinds of fancy terrain that does all kinds of different stuff to people. That has actually been really, really useful, because if you just randomly pick one item in there and incorporate it into your combat, it adds whole new dimensions. There's this one type of grass that will grab at people, and it makes it more difficult for them to actually get up. I think it makes it like a full round action for you to get up if you've been knocked down. So then you throw in a bunch of monsters that are good at knocking people down, and the players will quickly catch on that they need to start knocking down the bad guys too.
Well, it's called using the terrain to your advantage.
Mm-hmm.
So.
The name of that, it's Dungeon Crawl Classic number 50, Vault of the Iron Overlord.
Oh, okay.
So. People want to check that out.
Might need to check that out, yeah.
That's very cool.
Neat.
So, I think that I'm good for my section, I think. That was just one of those things I wanted to bring up because I kept thinking about those flip mats. And, we had that discussion. It's like, when would you use these things? And I couldn't think of when I would use them, but I just kept thinking,
would find a way to use those.
I actually think I would. It would be like I'd have to figure a way to get them inside, a whale or something just to do it.
Yeah.
you're in search of Pinocchio, yes.
See if they get out the same way with the smoke and everything. I'm sure someone will.
Oh, yeah.
Someone will figure something.
I'm sure they will. So, well, that would be it for that segment. And next up, we have Zach. You have something?
Yes.
But the most interesting thing about it is that you're discussing predictability in gaming, correct?
That's correct.
That's actually an interesting topic because, we never really think about most people don't really think about that too much in gaming, that there is statistical probabilities that certain things will happen with dice.
Yeah, and that's, some people get really hot and heavy into that. I've never been one, and it's probably a future topic with someone better learned on that than I. But, there are certain, how do we say this, there are certain expectations of how your dice are going to act. If you are playing in a baseline D20 game, if you're rolling a flat 1D20, you've got about a 5% chance of rolling that critical D20 or that critical 20. and that may be it. You roll to confirm, and then you crit. There are other games that are not as static as that, that have the exploding dice. If you roll a 6, then you roll another 6. Or in Rollmaster, if you roll a 96 to a double aught, then you roll again, and you keep rolling until you don't roll a 96 to a double aught on your percentiles.
Yeah, the whole open-endedness. Let's see, Rollmaster has that. Savage Worlds, too, right?
Yeah.
Deadlands.
Exploding Dice, it's awesome.
Exploding Dice, that's right. There are a number of games that either have open-ended or exploding dice, and then there are games that are more static. Go ahead.
Well, I was about to say, I think there are other games that where it seems to me like you get to roll some extra dice if you so choose. I think some games have like dice pools. Where you can like pull an extra die.
I didn't want that to seem like it's an either or. There's a number of areas in between, and there are also, if you do this, you add on and add on, and certainly dice pool also. And of course, you can have dice pools that also work as exploding dice. Yeah, it goes on and on. There are so many different dice mechanics if you think about it.
You opened ended to infinity.
Exactly.
Yeah. So. There was actually somebody online just the other day who posted up an idea for a brand new dice mechanic, and everybody said, dude, those are the dice mechanics for Risk.
Hey, if it works, right?
Yep.
get the regional feat for Kamchatka or wherever. Yeah. I've always found that interesting that some players want a more static approach. And some players seem to want that open-endedness. We were talking, we did Traveler character generation 2 weeks ago, and we carpool in, and on the ride home, we talk about gaming and stuff, and I was talking about the next fantasy game I was going to run down the road, and to the guys I was talking with were both in my old Rollmaster campaign. And I said, well, what did you like about Rollmaster that you want to play it again? Because it was the worst character generation session we ever had. It went on 8 hours. I think one girl started crying because of the math. And I mean, it was awful. I mean, it was a fantastic campaign.
Was that this RM2 or is that RMSS?
No, we were playing Rollmaster FRP.
Oh.
And that's the one where by the end of it, Jeff, we had gutted everything pretty much except, you know you're rolling percentiles, you got skills, you got critical hits, that's about it. Oh, and spells, you know. And if I run it again, that's how I'll run it because, you know, it's just like any other game, you use the parts you need. So, and I said, what do you like that much about Rollmaster? And they said, well, we like the unpredictability. We like the idea that we have a shot at doing anything. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a shot at, even if we're level one and we are, by our own stupidity, backed up against this dark demon lord, I know I can throw my axe and maybe, if I roll 3 open-ended rolls in a row, I can get the guy. And they liked that. They also liked the critical hit charts, which are pretty funny. But
and the fumble charts.
I love the critical hit charts. But it's to them, the idea that any roll was a potential just blockbuster. Any roll potentially could become a game changer. Even though it wasn't likely, they still had hope.
Mm-hmm.
But then I was talking with another friend from an earlier game, and he was saying he didn't like the fact that on just an errant whim, basically, all his hard work could be undone because of one crappy roll, or that little kobold with the spear got really lucky, open-ended 4 times, and stabbed you through the eye.
Yeah.
So he wanted a more static, I would say, kind of baseline D20 experience. You know, oh, okay, well, I got a D20. Let's see if it's a crit rolled, see if it's a critical. Okay, well, fine. Double damage at most. So, I understand both, but I think it's interesting how it seems like on one side you have people who want more of the unpredictability, and on the other side you have risk management and perhaps more of an adherence to what they feel the game should go like.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Do your guys' players fall anywhere in that axis? Do they want more of the predictability, or do they like the unpredictability of exploding or open-ended dice, or is there a compromise in there?
You know, I actually think it depends on the type of game that they're playing.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I think they like the concept of the exploding die in Savage Worlds doing pulp adventures, because that was very pulpy to them to do something, have that be a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
But then for fantasy, I tend to think they want a little more predictability. They want that a little bit more control over their destiny, if you will. You know, they want to know that they're that powerful and this is their acceptable range. So I think it depends on what their expectations of the game and setting are.
Yeah, I think my fantasy might be a little more pulpy or something, because I've always seen that idea of you can do anything to be both with fantasy and pulp to a point. But a lot of people run much lower fantasy or more gritty fantasy than I do, I think, as a baseline.
Yeah, I think I tend to run a little bit more gritty fantasy, but I think that's my reaction to the fact that a lot of fantasy games I've seen are just way too fantastical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, it's like, okay, I'm tired. You know, it's like the typical, I'm tired of seeing every player want to be a drow ranger or whatever the case may be.
You know,
I want to be able to do all this stuff. I know I can. It was in a book. I don't really care. You know,
Rolemaster's weird about that, because on one hand you have an incredibly lethal combat system. One where, I mean, and it is true, you know, you always read about how, you know, an inexperienced swordsman or an inexperienced warrior can be very dangerous because they're so unpredictable. And so that time where, you know, the guy gets the arrow through the eye, just plain dumb luck, there's plenty of examples to back that up. So it's lethal in that sense, but it also allows for the fantastic, because if you just keep open-ending it, keep open-ending a spell roll or something ridiculous, you know, all sorts of just magnificently weird stuff can happen that definitely belongs more in a higher fantasy sort of setting.
Mm-hmm. If you think about it, just look at Bard in The Hobbit. I mean, he killed a smog with a nat 20 followed by a nat 20 followed by a nat 20.
Yeah.
And that's not...
In Rolemaster terms, he just open-ended a lot.
and that's not a pulpy fantasy at all. I mean, that's the classic high fantasy. So I don't think it's necessarily has to be for just pulp games you could have the open-ended. Sometimes people just end up really, really lucky. And that's what it sort of shows. And I know my players prefer the more pulp, you know, fly by the seat of your pants, do as much damage as humanly possible type stuff. So, and actually, I was listening to an interview on Fear the Boot with the guy who's coming out with the Dresden Files RPG, and apparently
Fred
the Dresden
Hicks?
File, with Fred Hicks, and he was saying that it's going to be open-ended. But that's not necessarily a good thing, because, I mean, if you're releasing a fireball spell, it you know, explodes and ends up enveloping the entire apartment building that you're in, and then you're screwed. So
that's a game we're
having
gonna
open-ended
have to
things, yeah, I'm definitely going to be looking at picking that up.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it can work both ways.
Yeah, it isn't always necessarily a good thing.
Yeah. Oh, hey, look, you kept open-ending, and, you know, you're fireball, your firebolt is now the size of Nagasaki, you know, or something like that. I can see that. That's interesting.
Your magic getting out of your own control.
Right. So, I think it's an interesting split, and I'm curious to see. Some of my players have not played Rolemaster with me before, and I'm wondering if we played just what they'd think of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? I think initially it's all going to be a matter of what their expectations are.
Sure.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, I think that's what it is. If people are willing to accept a game that has possible fantastical outcomes, open-ended systems tend to be more popular. But if they don't want things so fantastical, or they don't like the fact that there is a snowball's chance in hell that some outcome could possibly happen, then they're not going to like those type of systems.
Yeah.
I would say, like, for me, modern games would be something where I'd want a more predictable statistical outcome. You know, doing the Law and Order RPG or whatever you want to say. So, you know, something like that. I would play that. No, oh, man, in a minute. That'd be awesome. Yeah. So you'd have to have the music, though, at the beginning of every session. And, like, in between your scenes or whatever on breaks, you'd have to have a little dun-dun. You know, that's it. I'm just brainstorming. Boy, I'm going to have to play this now, man. I wonder how much a license would cost to have a Law and Order RPG.
Oh, I don't know. I'm pretty sure they'd be just like, I think we're going to arrest you because you're taking drugs.
Yeah. I don't know what sort of psychedelic substance you're on, sir, to think that would be successful. But
I do know that the Cortex role-playing game has the ability to do courtroom scenes.
They do. And Cortex does a lot of shows. They're doing Supernatural. Smallville's coming out.
Law and Order. Do it.
Law and Order.
wow.
Not yet.
That'd be awesome.
Right.
I don't know. It would be interesting, but I agree. It's like, would there be really a market for that? I don't know.
It's hard to tell. I don't know. You know, they've done some interesting shows. They have the one on TBS with, what's the name of it? They have one other show that I thought, well, that's strange for an RPG, but it's the one with I can't think of it. It's like kind of like a crook Ocean's 11 kind of show. They go around doing
Leverage.
Bad things to bad people. Leverage, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So I mean, they have a Leverage RPG. The Leverage RPG. It's out this summer, I believe. So
wow.
I mean, hey.
Talk about being out of the loop.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? It's interesting. If they have that, can a Law and Order RPG really be that far off?
So, I don't think so.
Yeah, it's coming. I can feel it.
Well, you know, that was the whole promise of having systems that you could easily adapt to various settings. Was, you know, you could have that kind of turnkey. One person once described it to me as, you know, you have video games that look completely different, act completely different, but they use the same game engine.
Oh, yeah, like everything that's run on the Quake engine nowadays.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, how could that be run on the Quake engine? It's a completely different game than anything else. But
and if you look at the Cortex system, it's not a bad fit for that sort of thing. It can easily be modified. It's a pretty good baseline, I can see, for a number of systems like that. So, or a number of settings, rather. So.
Yeah.
All right. Well, any closing comments, I think, for predictability in gaming?
No, I think that's it. It's something that I'm going to continue to see. If I do end up running Rollmaster again, I'm curious to see kind of where the divide is and how certain things go over.
Yeah, and I think I would challenge our listeners. If you swing one way or the other, send us your thoughts. We'd be more than happy to hear those.
Please. Yeah.
Speaking of comments, we actually have one this week from Ben, who sent us an audio comment via email. Mm-hmm. So let's go ahead and listen to what he has to say.
Hey, this is Ben. That's a comment on RPG Circus Season 2, Episode 6, and Virtual Tabletops. You made a comment about that you get overly detailed with the maps. I tell you how I do it. I draw it on a piece of graph paper. Take out the digital camera, and I shoot a picture, and I'm done. Virtual tabletops are just spectacular, especially if your friends are remote. Personally, I use the RP Tools one. It's a Java multi-platform. You'd like it. But you should give them a shake. They're pretty good. Thanks.
Well, you know, Ben, you're absolutely right. We forgot to mention that I think that virtual tabletops have a big market in terms of remote playing with a whole bunch of people. I've seen that used quite a bit. Matter of fact, that's how I played T20 Traveler initially. because I got to...
that's right, yeah.
I got to play, you know, with Mr. Hunter Gordon, and his name is Hunter Gordon, right?
Yes.
Okay. It was a long time ago, but I used the old grip software, and we played some early T20, and that was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, he brings up a good comment. You don't have to get overly complex. I just think that the way the tools are, people are kind of, you get sidetracked.
Yeah. You can, but yeah. I like the point, you know, hey, draw up that map or find the old map you had, take a picture, get it in there, and that's it. You know, you're ready to rock and roll. You don't have to be a whiz in Photoshop or something, which I think sometimes, you know, with the electronic and the computer stuff, we can get bogged into, oh, I need this accessory, I need this accessory program, I need this accessory program. Because, you know, we're geeks, we like to tinker with that stuff.
But exactly.
There are some old analog shortcuts you can use, I think.
So very good comment. Thank you for sending that to us. If any of the rest of you have some comments, you can always email us at info@rpgcircus.com or, of course, leave us a voicemail. And we have a couple of ways to send us a voicemail if you'd like. You can call us at 1-888-643-6322. That was 1-888-643-6322. And the other way is to contact us via Skype. RPG Circus is the username. And you can actually send us a comment via Twitter as well. We do have a Twitter account for RPG Circus. It is, quite obviously, RPG Circus. And don't forget, we do have comments. So if you have you can always contact us on our blog pages for the episodes and leave a comment there. And we will always typically respond to those. And I think that just about wraps up. Do we have any closing comments before we go?
No, it was good to be back finally.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, that was very good. So, okay, why don't we just wrap it up? And we'll see everyone in hopefully 2 weeks. The preceding podcast is released under a Creative Commons 3.0 Attribution US license. For more information, go to creativecommons.org.